I think she would be a great addition to the department.
Not with genuine academic interest.
All right. So that's the theory. Now, what are the problems? What, how should we think about this? This, the architecture of this argument. First, the theory of crisis intensification. So this is a pretty central part of the argument. It's not really. Sometimes people feel that the crisis theory of Marxism is just simply one among many parts of the argument for capitalism's future, but I think it's pretty central. And it's not just the argument that capitalism has crisis tendencies. That's a well-established argument that many mainstream economists also believe in, that left to its own devices and its own internal dynamics, capitalism generates all sorts of imbalances and boom and bust cycles. The key argument that Marx makes that other people didn't and still don't is the notion that there's some tendency for crises to become more intense over time. And for that theory, I think there is good reason to be skeptical. It's not so much, I don't think the converse has been shown. That is, the strong skepticism would be to demonstrate that there is no intensification tendency. I don't think that's been demonstrated. But Marx's particular arguments that crises intensify in such a way that we can, with reasonable confidence, predict the long-term self-destruction of capitalism, that it will destroy its own conditions of existence. I don't think we have good grounds for that theory. Marx underestimated the extent to which state interventions can significantly moderate these tendencies. So even if it were the case that there was some inherent endogenous reason why crises would intensify over time, if there's also endogenous processes to create counter-strategies with the state being the central mechanism for it, so that the effects of those crisis tendencies are much weaker, then the predictions from the intensification don't hold. The rate of profit may be lower in highly developed stages of capitalism than in earlier stages of capitalism. That seems reasonable. Rates of growth are slower in general in highly developed forms of capitalism than in less developed forms of capitalism. But there does not, I think, appear to be a long-term tendency for it to, secular tendency for the rate of profit to decline. Some people have argued there is, but I am not convinced by the evidence I've seen. It's exceedingly hard to measure the aggregate social rate of profit because of the complexity of the assumptions that have to go into it. The big problem with measuring the rate of profit, there are two big problems with measuring it. One is how to figure out what the denominator is. That a rate of profit has a numerator and a denominator. You can measure the gross revenues of the system in a given year, but you have to subtract something from that to get a separable numerator and denominator, and that's just really hard to do. And the reason is that the denominator contains the costs of production, but the costs of production depend upon the rate of depreciation of capital. You know, you buy a factory and buy new machines and technologies, and they cost you $100 million. Well, the $100 million cost does not appear in a single year because you use that capital over 10 years, 20 years, whatever. And so you have to amortize the costs of capital over the life of the use of the capital in order to get a rate of profit. Right? And that turns out to be, I think, an impossible task. Now, economists claim that they've solved it in various ways. The details of how you solve it get incredibly arcane. And I think it's a lot of hand-waving. So that's one problem. Added to that is the problem of the relationship between the money price of things and the real price because of inflation. And that, and so that if you're going to value the amount of capital that was bought and then its rate of depreciation, that all has to be adjusted for rates of inflation. In an economy in which the content of what you're producing changes rapidly, you know, so what was the qualities of what you're producing change rapidly. Adjusting the rates of inflation, I think, is intractable. I don't think it's just difficult. I think it's impossible. And small differences in how you do this make huge differences in your estimates of things. I mean, just a very simple example. The simplest example, of course, is computers. Are computers more or less expensive today? Well, you can't answer the question, really, because you can't buy the same kind of computer that was available 10 years ago today. It's impossible to find it to know how much it would cost. My laptop would cost $150 billion 30 years ago, so to speak. I mean, it was unavailable. Its computing power is greater than the entire University of Wisconsin computing system was when I came. Yeah, you know, it's just the qualitative changes in these goods means that you can't compare the prices over time. And therefore, what your overall price indexes are, what you need in order to calculate these rates of profit, depends upon what you put into the basket that you're going to measure to adjust your prices. And added to this is in an economy where non-material goods become an increasing part of economic activity, and the issue of what the price of a service is even, and how to include that in your productivity and in your price deflating, metrics, becomes even more intractable.
But these aren't like problems specific to specific to Marxists.
No. It's a problem, but it means that we don't know. The question is, do we know whether the rate of profit is declining or not?
Right.
So in order to answer that question, you have to solve all these problems.
Right, and which is why I think people try to give a number of different estimates for the rate of profit.
Yeah, but I don't believe any of them. I really think that I don't think these are the kinds of problems where you can say, well, here's the range of possibilities, because the very range of possibilities imply intractable problems and to get the limits as well. So I'm very skeptical of when I see results that show a long-term decline in the rate of profit. I'm very skeptical of them. I'm not skeptical of the argument that highly productive economies have a lower rate of profit than low productive economies, so that there's a decline, comparative statics. But among mature economies, that the rate of profit should have a continuing tendency to fall, I'm skeptical of. You don't have to be skeptical, I'm just saying I'm skeptical of them because I think the problems of measurement are too big to get plausible estimates. They could all be off by orders of magnitude, not just by little bits. Yeah.
But if you admit the labor theory of value, it actually doesn't matter if you are living a computer 20 years ago in a computer now.
It does. It still matters because with the labor theory of value, I think the claim that the capital intensity has gone up is not plausible. If you believe in the labor theory of value, capital intensity has probably declined over time because capital is produced so cheaply now. You know, a laptop computer embodies less labor now than a mechanical calculator did 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, you had mechanical adding machines, these big clunky things. That one person used that to calculate stuff. One person uses a hand calculator now. It's a dramatic decline in capital intensity. There's no reason to believe that there's an increase in capital intensity because capital is being, machines are being produced so much more efficiently, and the technology that you're using embodies so much less labor now than in the past. So when you move from tools to machines, you clearly increase capital intensity. Once you start replacing machines by machines, there's no reason whatsoever for the capital intensity to go up. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. The incentive structure for capitalists is to try to lower the cost of capital as much as it is to try to lower the cost of labor, because machines are such an important expense in their total production, and therefore there's no particular tendency for the organic composition of capital to go up over time. There's no reason why you should expect it to. And therefore, I think the falling rate of profit, even from within the labor theory of value framework, there's no reason to expect there to be a long-term falling rate of profit once you've reached a high level of capital intensity to begin with. Yeah.
I think one mechanism that might generate a rising organic composition of capital is the fact that the wage sharing over time has been roughly constant. And since the wage share has been high and stable, there's always an inducement for, since labor is relatively expensive, there's always an inducement for labor-saving technical change.
But there's also, since the biggest costs of production are still capital, there's always an incentive for capital saving. I mean, there's just no reason to imagine that one is a stronger force than the other. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes one will be, sometimes another will be, but there's no reason to imagine that on balance, the main pressure in capitalist competition is to substitute cheap machines for expensive machines because you save even more on labor, as opposed to substitute cheap machines for expensive machines because then you save on capital as well. Either way is going to improve your competitive position. And I just don't think there's to me there's no convincing argument why one pressure should be greater than the other. And particularly in the context of global capitalism, where you can solve the labor cost problem by moving to cheaper labor economies, that even further reduces the pressure for labor-saving innovation over capital-saving innovation. And without that mechanism, I don't see a reason to believe that there is a general intensification of crisis tendencies. So therefore, the very first of the key theses does not seem well grounded, given our present state of knowledge of the mechanisms involved. Now, in light of this, it's possible, and I think there's really interesting work that people and ideas around this, it's possible that we need a whole new theory of the self-destructive tendency of capitalism. Maybe the strategy that Marx adopted, which was a good one, very elegant, the falling rate of profit, that one had this great advantage, but it was really a systemic argument about how the aggregate of the system functioned. But maybe there's some other notions of the non-sustainability of capitalism. So one possible is environmental, ecological socialism. So another kind of argument that's been made about the non-sustainability of capitalism is not that it destroys its economic conditions of existence, it destroys its natural conditions of existence. That the ecological effects of capitalism destroy the possibility of sustainability of capitalism. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that globalization destroys the capacity for capitalism to self-regulate because it changes the geographical scale at which capital accumulation takes place relative to the geographical scale at which regulation takes place. So as long as capitalism was primarily cabined within nation states, then state regulatory mechanisms could develop in tandem with capitalist crisis tendencies so that new and imaginative regulatory interventions could contain and reproduce capitalist conditions for accumulation. Because the state is the primary device we have for countering the self-destructive anarchic tendencies of capitalism. the breaking out of that national structure of capitalism towards a genuinely globalized form of capitalism in the last 50 years or so, the argument goes, creates a very different situation where the regulative capacity of capitalism simply doesn't exist any longer and cannot be reconstructed unless a global state could be created, and a global state is impossible under capitalist conditions. So that's a different kind of contradictory argument. That is, here the argument is, capitalism has enormously destructive crisis tendencies. It's not that they're getting worse, it's just that our ability to contain them gets worse. We get a degradation in our steering mechanisms, not an intensification of the crisis mechanisms, but the result is an intensification of experienced crisis. Right? So you see why that's a different kind of argument from the falling rate of profit argument. The falling rate of profit argument is that the crises themselves become more intense. This is, the crises are just cycles, but they were previously dampened by steering mechanisms, and the dampening capacity is what's falling apart. That also would make the system more vulnerable, if that were true. That's a second kind of argument. A third kind of argument about what's new and how capitalism is may become unsustainable is that the shift from an industrial economy to a knowledge economy fundamentally changes the problem of defending property rights. So that the industrial economy, the core property rights of capitalism were fairly easily defended by courts and police. That is, the repressive apparatus and the law, the legal structure of capitalism, was able to reproduce the class relations of capitalism through the enforcement of property rights. Once you move from an industrial economy to a knowledge economy, perhaps a dubious idea, but nevertheless a popular one, it is much, much more difficult to protect property rights. And the subversion of and the erosion of capitalist property rights, ranging from things like piracy to downloading music to open source software to Wikipedia, which destroyed the market for encyclopedias, you know, these are all just the cutting edge of what will be in the 21st century a massive erosion of the property rights regime of capitalism. And the costs, the social productivity costs of trying to re-establish control over those property rights are so pathological and transparent that it won't be successful. So there is the argument that capitalism will reach its limits of possibility because it can no longer sustain its property rights. That argument is a little bit more like the feudalism to capitalism argument, where feudal property relations were eroded by the emergent merchant capitalists who were able, inside of feudalism, to do things so much better than the old feudal restrictions were, that gradually feudal property rights had essentially disintegrated by the time they were finally put to rest. So there's this imagery, it has more of an anarchist flavor than a traditionally socialist one, that these emergent cooperative peer-to-peer knowledge-producing relations of production, which are more egalitarian and democratic in their very form, will just gradually encroach upon capitalism and define and make capitalism itself no longer sustainable. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a hard time in those three positions to see the dynamics of class struggle.
Sure.
Me.
Right. So I'm just saying that these are three lines of argument that you see. Three lines of argument that are very different from the falling rate of profit, that argue about the vulnerability of the system for transformation. Remember, the falling rate of profit argument itself is not in the first instance a class struggle argument. It's what makes the system more vulnerable to class struggle. But the falling rate of profit argument is primarily a competition argument. That is, it's primarily driven by the competition among capitalists, which leads to aggregate falls in the rate of profit, which makes the system more vulnerable to class struggle, but the class struggle thesis is the second thesis. And which is really, it has its own independent groundings. So you could combine each of these. You could say that the regulative capacity of the state over capital accumulation is declining, so the crises will increase in severity. And that's what then makes the system more fragile, and therefore makes it more possible for class struggles to have an impact on transformation. If that would be the globalization version of this scenario. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not understanding like the globalization argument too well, because I mean, isn't it the case that, I mean, don't we see that already being countered anyways? Like, for example, areas, nation states coming together and forming a union of an economic unions, but so that that's no longer an issue.
So that would be the counter argument. So the argument is, globalization means that the geographical scope of accumulation is vastly greater than the geographical scope of effective regulation. The counter-argument is, yes, but we're already seeing in the EU, for example, as the best case, and in relatively weak but nevertheless non-trivial global regulatory mechanisms like, you know, the World Trade Organization, we're already seeing the emergence of regulatory mechanisms of broader scope. These are all way less effective than the previous national regulatory regimes. But, of course, national regulatory regimes were way less effective when they first emerged than when they matured. So one scenario is that although we are unlikely to have a world government, the global capitalist class could organize global capitalist institutions of regulation, which wouldn't have a democratic and fully state-like character, but might do the job well enough. That is, that it might regulate global accumulation sufficiently to dampen down the amplitudes of the crisis again. So the system would then muddle through in its non-vulnerable form. You don't have to eliminate crisis tendencies in order to have a stable system. You just have to dampen them. Just like human bodies can have a bad cold, which is extremely annoying, but doesn't create mortality. all we need to do is dampen the amplitudes of our disease processes, yeah.
It sounds like, implicit in what you're saying, and I also was getting this from the Envisioning Real Utopias reading, is that the category of capitalism is more useful as an adjective than it is as a noun. It characterizes social formations, but it doesn't, is not something that's monolithically capitalistic. Things are more or less capitalistic and become more or less over time. If that's true, then it's another criticism of the classical theory of history, right? That you don't have a determinate end to capitalism because capitalism is a characteristic. It's not a thing in itself.
So, yeah, so that proposal, the proposal that we move from a binary notion of systems in which we identify the nature of a system by the ideal type that seems most relevant to it, so that hybrid systems which contain capitalism are called capitalist simply by virtue of capitalism being the dynamic force within them. So we move another response to some of the limitations of the classical theory is to move towards a more fully elaborated theory of hybrid systems in which then we pose the problem of transcending capitalism in a different way. That's one of the issues we'll be discussing on the weekend retreat. That's an alternative way of thinking through the issue of transcending capitalism, is that you think through it via the concept of hybrid rather than binary shifts from one system to another.
Aren't we already doing that, though, by calling things like social democracies, for example?
Yeah, those are social democracy. This would be one way of thinking about social democracy. Now, Marxists have often thought of social democracy not in that way, but they've seen it as just another not as a hybrid between capitalism and something that's non-capitalist, but rather a particular form of capitalism. So it's simply a kind of add-on that neutralizes certain of the consequences of capitalism, but it doesn't change the nature of capitalism per se. Whereas the hybrid argument really says that these add-ons actually change the character of the way the system functions. So it does constitute a different theoretical move, because it means it changes the level of abstraction at which you can describe the central dynamics of the system. In one view, you can always define these central dynamics by this higher level of abstraction, the capitalist mode of production. In the hybrid view, that level of abstraction is no longer really available. If you have a genuine hybrid, you cannot specify its dynamics at that higher level of abstraction. The dynamics have to be specified through interaction, because that is the dynamics is the interaction. It's not from the separable components of the system. It's from the interaction of its components. So in a way, I mean, this is getting us a little bit off of the topic, but just to clarify this metaphor, we think of water as a genuine hybrid of hydrogen and oxygen. Right? It's not. The theory of how hydrogen works and the theory of how oxygen works as separate atoms doesn't tell you how H2O works in its providing one of the ingredients necessary for plants to grow. The theory of how hydrogen and oxygen work together requires the study of the hybrid. Now, that doesn't imply that you don't acknowledge that water is made up of those two components, but the system, we call that molecule, is a genuine system. It has its real ontological standing as a system, call it a compound, in which its properties are derived from the way in which two atoms of hydrogen interact with one atom of oxygen through particular forms of bonds and so on. Well, you know, metaphors are always both helpful and misleading. If you take seriously a notion of social hybrids as generating distinctive dynamics by virtue of the forms of interaction of its components, then it at least suggests that it may not be any longer appropriate to begin by specifying the dynamics of the system at a level of abstraction higher than hybrid, that is, talking about pure capitalism as such. It may be that you really have to discuss the dynamics at the level of the form of combination that we call the hybrid. That's a proposal as opposed to an established way of approaching the problem. Because I can't defend the hybrid notion either. As I can't give you the distinctive laws of motion of hybrids. I don't have anywhere near that level of understanding of what I'm talking about, so to speak. We do have to stop more promptly than usual, because there is an important faculty meeting prior to the Alice Goffman talk in which my absence will be noted. So I do need to get to that. I'll finish this up on Monday rather than jump to the next topic.